This was actually the first time I saw my dad cry. The second time was when I was diagnosed. That was two times I've seen my dad cry, but that was the first time when I was called up in the national team. He was over the moon, and I felt that, you know, that was his dream.
Yes, come on in, everyone. This is More Than a Name, the podcast that explores the untold, unfiltered stories of elite athletes and sports figures. I'm Max Whittle. He's Luke Young. Between us, we have 378 Premier League appearances.
Well, between me and you, yeah, for sure. Yeah, I thought you were trying to mention standing in that as well. But
today's guest is a former teammate of yours, Luke. It's everybody's favourite number 19, Stylian Petrov. His 105 international appearances make him the most capped male player in Bulgaria's history. Everywhere he went, from representing his country to CSKA Sofia, Celtic and Aston Villa, he wore the captain's armband. While at Villa in 2012, Stylian was diagnosed with leukemia. During his treatment and recovery, he showed the same fight and class that football fans all over the world have always loved about him. The man from Montana, Stylian Petrov, welcome to More Than a Name.
Hello, guys. Look, great
welcome,
to see you.
Stan.
Max, great to meet you. I mean, I've got a new shirt. My wife said that's the new fashion, so I've got it. I look huge, but you know what, that's the fashion. So I'm looking forward to speak to you guys.
You're looking good. When was the last time you guys bumped into each other?
Probably about 3 or 4 years ago now, Stan, as a little, you know, sort of annual visit to Ibiza. And we met up when we was both there, and it was always great to catch up with Stan and the family.
First time you met at Villa, do you remember the day?
I do remember the day. I remember meeting every one of my teammates. I mean, Luke was brilliant when he came to Villa. It's just not about his footballing career and what he've achieved in football, but also as a human being. This was the most important thing. He was really loud in the dressing room. He loved moaning about stuff, which made him even more special. He fit right in it. But he was very reliable, and you don't see many of those players those days. He came in, he fit really, really well. He was demanding from everybody else. And, you know, for me as a captain, was really great to see Luke being in a dressing room, because sometimes a good captain needs other leaders to lead in the right way.
Who worked harder, Luke?
Oh, that'd be a close one.
We both worked.
Couple of the hardest workers within the squad and in training. One thing about Stan, I would say, as a captain, is that he wasn't just leading by example. He was vocal as well. He could do both of it. It wasn't one or the other. He had both. And I don't think he needed the armband anyway, because I think as a character and as a player, that was natural to him. Like, he wasn't trying to be a captain. It just became something that was really easy for him and a natural way for him to lead.
Do you think you learn to be a leader, or you just have that in yourself? I think you either have it or don't have it.
Looking at you lead as a captain when I was at Villa, it looked effortless, so it didn't seem like he was trying to be the captain or trying to lead. And one thing that he could do as well was he could be the captain, but he could also be one of the boys. And I think that's a really good skill to have, because often a captain can sometimes isolate themselves if they're, you know, they've got to be a bit of authority about them and stuff like that. But Stan was one of the boys, led by example, demanded that we do better, do more in training, make sure that everyone was at the level that they needed to be for the weekend. So I think it was natural for Stan. Maybe he can answer that better than I can, but it seemed very natural that was just the way he was.
Maybe he came from early age. I think my dad was really demanding. Look, I think he was one of these old-fashioned. I think now it's the youth development, that, you know, the parents try to be protective and you can't say this, you can't say that. My dad was ruthless. Mm. I mean, my dad was ruthless from early age. I mean, demanding to be the best, even when I was playing with older players and I was playing with a bigger age group, his demand was that you have to go and you have to lead, you have to demand, you have to be the best. And you know what, sometimes in the current system is about, people talk about, he has to enjoy it. My dad always said, you have to win it. Mm. If you want to be recognizable, if people want to recognize who you are, you have to be a leader. You have to show that determination that you show in the house, you show every day in front of me, your mom, your brother. You have to show with your teammates. Mm. And I think that probably helped me to fight every single time through difficult moments, through good moments, because, you know, look, we've been through difficult moments. You know that it's sometimes you kind of struggle mentally, and but we knew what we had to do. As players, you knew what you had to do. You have to be disciplined. You have to work hard. You have to believe in your abilities. You have to wait for your moments. At the moment, I don't really see leaders in the football club. I see a lot of like robots and, you know, players that are waiting for somebody to show them the way rather than go and demand. That's what we've done as a teammate. We always demanded from each other. You always pushed each other. We hated losing.
And I think what Stan mentioned there about having that resilience as a youngster, it's gone out of the game a little bit now. You know, we used to have to do all the jobs, clean the balls, make sure the stadium was spotless, the change rooms after first team games, stuff like that. And it builds that sort of camaraderie within the camp. But also you realise that you're not a professional yet. You haven't made it yet, and you're still striving to become a professional footballer. When I feel like sometimes these youngsters feel like they've made it before they've actually stepped foot in a first team.
I wanted to ask you about your dad, but first, you've just touched on something. So did you guys clean boots?
My early days in professional football, when I made my debut when I was 15, and I remember cleaning the boots and the first team players, and I loved it. You know, I loved it because when you have a dream and when you want to be part of that first team, you get closer and you get closer. You get the attention from the main players, for the players that make a difference. You go and watch them every single weekend. And to be closer to them, for me, it was a great honor, you know, to clean boots and to be part of it, to show me that I'm getting closer. Even being, you know, in a first team environment, cleaning boots is like you're feeling the excitement that you want to be part of it. You want one day to be, you know, somebody else will clean my boots. And I hope I give him the same, you know, excitement about, you know, coming to the first team. So for me, it was brilliant. I think, I don't think that's allowed anymore.
No, it felt like the next step. So you could see that was part of your learning curve, and that was the next step. And you could see where you was headed, because like Stan said, one day you're going to be in the first team, someone's going to be doing your boots. But then they stopped doing that completely and it was banned, and the lads, the young lads now, they don't do jobs at all.
You cleaned Stan's boots, didn't you, at Villa?
You're kidding me. Yeah, they probably try, maybe do it, yeah.
Some of the players, I remember Barry Banner, you know, Matt O'Brien, at that time they were coming through Villa and they were cleaning boots. But you know what, having conversation, they see them after that training with us, they felt more comfortable, more relaxed and more supported.
Going back to what you were saying about your dad and your upbringing, how was he ruthless in terms of watching you train? Was he always around?
He was traveling everywhere. He was watching every single game. My distance from where I used to live to the stadium was about 40 minutes walk. My dad would never give me a lift. I remember me and my friend, we grew up together. We were waiting, you know, we were walking. My dad was passing with a car. He drove beside us. He just gave us a wave. We were drenched. He just gave us a wave. And that thought me that moment is like, you have to respect the what you do and you have to appreciate it. If you don't do it yourself, if you don't get up in the morning, you don't really want that to be your life, you'll never succeed. And that was his mentality. If you want to train, you have to be up. You have to set up your alarm. You have to do your breakfast. You have to prepare your boots. You have to be ready. And when that happened and I go and train, he's there. He's there sitting on the side, watching it. And when I go back home, he was like, okay, what you've done today in training? What do you think you've done wrong? What do you think you've done right? At the start, it was great. Same as the game as well. You come and watch the game, it's what you've done wrong, what you've done right. At one point, after 2-3 years, you're thinking, I don't want to speak to him again. It's too much pressure. But that pressure made me realize one thing. You have to be able to understand the game. You have to be able to understand what you need to be better, what you need to work on, what your strengths are, and how you can improve it yourself when you do something wrong, you have to be able to find a solution very quickly. And I've learned that very, very early in my life because my dad was just, will not rest. He would not rest. We will have arguments. My mom, she was a sports person as well. She was in athletics. She comes from a sports family as well. So she kind of understood. But at one point, the pressure was so much.
Overbearing pressure from your dad for you to be a player?
I'll give you an example. My brother, who was a better talent than me, he could never succeed. And he was all down from the pressure from my dad. My brother would not accept it. My brother would not accept that kind of intensity, pressure about, you know what, you have to do it. This is your life. If you want to have a good life, you have a success of life, you have to do it. And you have to do it every day, every minute, every second. And at one point I was thinking, is that too much? But you know, when I got to 15, when I had my first opportunity to make my debut in a professional football, then you sit back in the bus and you're thinking, you know, all these sacrifices, all the pressure, now I can see why he's doing it. And he drove that game, was about 2.5 hours away. He drove that game. I only played 3 minutes. And those 3 minutes, he tried to find out what I felt. Was I nervous? What I think I could have done better? It was extra time in the, you know, 90 minutes, only 3 minutes. And he picked up about 7 different things about what I haven't done. I think I've touched the balls about 5 or 6 times. I think I loved it. I love that challenge and that pressure to people to demand more and more and more. I needed that energy, enthusiasm. And I think that made me even stronger.
Why was it football for your dad? Why did he want you to become footballer?
Because he was a footballer.
Yeah.
He was a lazy footballer.
Well, that's why he probably wanted more from you.
Yes. He was exceptional. He was a great midfielder, left footer. He was typical number 10. Even when I was growing up, I still played football with him. But you know, when he get a little bit older, we played 6-a-side. And you can see his football brain, the way he was thinking. Technically, it was incredible. But work ethic, it was the worst. He was the worst. At the start, I wasn't the best technically in my age group, you know, when I was growing up. But then he kept asking me to work on my left foot, to work on my right foot, passing distances, short, mid-range, long range, you know, receiving the ball from different angle, understanding how I need to play. And obviously he saw in me that determination and resilience that I had, and he never had that in himself. And I think when I made my debut in the national team, I think it was like his dream. You know, I felt... This was actually the first time I saw my dad cry. The second time was when I was diagnosed. That was 2 times I've seen my dad cry, but that was the first time when I was called up in the national team. He was over the moon, and I felt that, you know, that was his dream.
Registered with him what he didn't do, and he'd realised that I can't afford to let my son be the same as what I...
Definitely, yeah. Because everybody was talking about his talent. My dad was exceptional talent, but everybody was talking about how lazy he was on the pitch, how laid back he was, and I don't think he wanted me to make his mistakes.
Paint a picture of Montana for us. What was childhood like?
Listen, it was good. It was good. School was good. My mum, obviously, after she retired from athletics, she became a PE teacher. So she was my PE teacher for a long time. I couldn't really skip schools or not be prepared at school. So that was really good for me. A small town, everybody know everyone. And you know, growing up with that expectation for me was difficult, especially when my dad was and my mum was quite famous and everybody knew them. So for me, it was like it's not a place or a mistake to fail. And for me, the pressure was really, really big, and everybody was talking about the next big thing coming from a small town, and you know, making it to the big stage.
I wanted to ask you that. Was people talking about you, not just in the town, but was it spreading far and wide that there was a...
Far and wide, and obviously I was playing in the national team. I went through every single age group. I was playing with the older age groups as well. So people start talking about it. I mean, it's a small town. We never really had anything special coming out from this small club, but I was something that everybody was talking about. It even when I was playing for the club, for the different age groups, you can see the people paying interest and the pressures building and building. But I love that. I love that. Bear in mind, I've cut football for about 2 years because I broke my arm about 6 times, and I was like, this is not going to work for me. And my dad was like, my dad would not speak to him if I don't. So we went to play one of the big teams in Sofia, Levski Sofia, and obviously they were aware who I was, what I was doing. I was already making steps into the first team. People were talking about it. So my dad said to me, this is different level. You played locally, now you're moving to the men's football, but this is a stronger team. So what I want you to do is just sit back, assess the situation, and then get into the game slowly. Young Stan, who never listened, first 30 seconds, taking the ball, passed 2 players, the third one took me, broke my arm, 30 seconds gone, everything finished. My dad did not speak to me for 6 months.
How old are you?
6 months.
6 months. Literally 6 months. My mom was like, you know, I walk into the apartment and you know what, you know what, as a kid, we believe that our parents are idols. You're looking into them and you want a little bit of encouragement, a little bit of a nice words or something nice to be told. He would not speak to him. His eyes would just move across the room and you'll see through me.
How did you build the determination to keep going?
Well, I wanted to prove him wrong.
For your whole career, do you think?
Yeah, I wanted to prove him wrong. I want to prove him wrong that somebody from a small town with not much ability, because I had the determination. I loved the challenge, but I wasn't the most technical. Look, I wasn't the fittest. I wasn't the best one up there. I had so many good teammates who never made it because of certain things. But for me, I loved that. I loved proving people wrong, and I think that's probably the best way. And I wanted to prove him wrong that I can do it.
I'm sure you're wondering the same thing. How did you start talking again? did you knock on his door?
No. I remember I was. They called me for under 15 national team, and he had to take me to the capital. So on the way there, we still haven't spoken for a long, long time. And you know what? Then he realized that I was a bit nervous. And he started talking about a little bit what to expect. He's been watching some of the boys, what to expect from them and who the manager was. And he'll be there. He'll watch the training session. He'll watch the game. And that's how we started speaking again. And it was all about football. Mm-hmm. Nothing about general, about father and son, you know, how are you, son? Everything okay? You know, how was school? And you know what? Where did you go? And what are you doing? No, man. It's like none.
So your relationship was brutal. Basically all about football and your career and how you're playing and performing.
It was brutal.
Yeah.
But
that's why you did what you did.
Yeah, of course.
Did it ever stop when you played for Sofia, Celtic, Villa? Was dad the same?
No, he's still doing it. He's still doing it. Even at the day I've played against Feyenoord for Celtic Legends and send him the link. He watched the game and he's a cheeky man. He said to me, you've got probably 2-3 years to go and I think you should quit. The opposition look a bit younger, Stan, so you have to really consider that. And I'm like, he'll never change. He'll just never change.
Did he ever encourage you in a positive way? Or was
No.
Don't remember any sort of time where he gave you a boost?
No. Even, you know what, when I passed my 100 games for the national team, he never said, you know, well done, son, you've done brilliantly. Never. It was one of these things that you will say, you know what, I'll still push you. I'm still here. I'm still alive. I'll be there and I'll make sure that you do it right.
So how do you parent?
Differently. My two boys don't play football. I'm completely different. My dad was really demanding. I mean, I can say we live in a completely different world.
We spoke about asking Stan, basically, when you're in Bulgaria and you're a young player and you're making a name for yourself, does everyone want to get out of Bulgaria and into the big European leagues as quickly as possible? Was that the kind of the route?
I couldn't wait. Look, and I'll give you why. I come from a country and it's, you know what, people talk different things about it. But when I was really young, I was 16. And by the way, this is still happening. I played in a game for my team Montana. And apparently the game was fixed, but I didn't know about it. And I was only 16. I remember playing that game. I was in school and somebody got injured. So I got into the squad and I've joined the team. And apparently the game was done. Some of the players knew, some of the players knew. I was only 16, never knew anything. And the game was 2-2, and I come on 82nd minute. And the manager, I remember, I still speak with friends, you know, teammates that have played in the youth. Still talking about the now and then. You know, he told me, just don't go forward. You're playing it on the left, don't go forward. And I was like, what is it? At that time, my team, Montana, they were safe, but the opposition, they were fighting for relegation. So they needed a point or to win to stay up. But the problem is, when you don't tell 16 years old boy that anything's going on, I'm coming in 87 minutes. There was the right winger was just taking the ball, beating two players, and young Stan is thinking, I'm going for it. I'm literally going for it. He crossed the ball. Everybody got under the ball. And I was on the left, look, and I hit it with my left foot. Unbelievable goal. 3-2, 90th minute. The game finished 3-2. I couldn't get in the dressing room. All the players that actually been involved in it, they will not let me get shower until they go home. It was raining. I was drenched and I was outside.
And you're thinking, I've just scored the winner, boys. Yeah?
I just scored the winner. I'm over the moon. And the mood in that dressing room was like, everybody's looking at me and I could not even get in. And, you know, at that moment I say, in that time there was so much great players in Bulgaria, like Stoichkov, Balakov, Kostadinov. They played in big teams. They just had a great World Cup 94. Mm. You know, I wanted to be like them. So when that happened, I went back home and I was telling my dad. Few of the players tried to have a go at me. My dad went ballistic. I was a local boy. And my dad went ballistic.
Did the players tell you when you got to the dressing room, Stan, this has been happening, you've scored the winner, you've ruined it?
You can see it. You can see it, the mood. You can see it straight away.
Did anyone celebrate with you when you scored?
No. Celebrated? No chance.
Why has he done that?
If I wasn't strong enough, probably that the pressure from my dad of going through moments like that, believing what you can do and believe that you've got a purpose and you try to follow it, he made me stronger. You know, then I realized if I ever become something, I'll never be something like that. Never not celebrate with somebody by scoring goal or being part of that. That's why I said I want to get out. But then I had an offer from CSK Sofia. I had to move to the capital on my own. I lived with Martin Petrov, who played for Man City. When I was younger, we played against each other because he's next city, so we were very close. We were playing in the same league, so I knew about Martin. So we were discussing, you know, what we wanted to become. It was obviously the champion, CSK. There was a lot of big players, a lot of international players. And, you know, we were only 17. we were only 17, first time in the capital, on my own, with Martin. I was wild. He was very professional. I'll tell you that. As much as I never been out, I never, you know, well, been drinking, you know, I was 16, 17. I never knew about a nightlife and how you can be hooked into trouble. Look, you know, but when you go to the capital, then it becomes a completely different story.
So what changed for you? And what did you have to potentially ignore?
I don't think he ignored it by the sounds of it.
Petrov ignored it. I haven't ignored it.
You bought
it. I was all over the place. I mean, in a good way. I love training. I've never been late for training. I'll be out from Monday to Thursday. I'll train, I'll sleep in the afternoon, and I'll be out until 6 in the morning, and I'll train 10 o'clock again. But I was just fit.
Was there other seniors doing the same? Back then, it was a known drinking culture, wasn't it?
Yeah, but the team was so good. Mm. But for me, it was just the beginning. And when you get into that environment, I mean, Luke, you know, you want to be part of it. You don't want to miss it. If they invite you, you go. You don't say no if you want to be part of it. And for me, it was important. With Martin, it was completely different. Martin was really professional. You'd not go out. You'd be in bed by 9 o'clock. You'd be ready in the morning. He had to wake me up. So
you're living together. You're going out and he's staying home.
He's staying home. And he just, you know, after that, on the bus to the training ground, he would just listen to story. He would just laugh. But that was me. I was, I remembered one of the days, the manager, because I was going out so much, he ordered for me to start living in the training ground. He was in the mountains. So for about 2 weeks, I was there. I've managed to escape a couple of times.
No clubs in the mountains then.
The best thing for me happened when I left Bulgaria. That's where I understood what you actually need.
Can I ask you, I know you wanted to go to the bigger European leagues and to leave Bulgaria. Was part of it to get away from the pressure of your dad as well? Was that?
Oh yeah, couldn't wait. I mean, my dad was in Montana. Sofia was about an hour and a half drive. He'll be pretty much every training and every game. Mm. At one point, I'm thinking, can't be happening. He's everywhere. Mm. He's everywhere. You know, sometimes you just want to have a little bit of a piece about, you know, just leave me, let me be, let me make my own mistakes. You know, but you'll never do it, because he probably knew I would go in a different direction. I mean, Sofia, it's the temptation there. It's a big city. It's the capital. You play in one of the biggest clubs in Bulgaria, the fan base, the excitement. You know, probably he thought, you know, I have to make sure he's doing the right things.
Before Celtic came calling, had you heard of interest from other clubs?
Yeah, I had interest from German team, Hertha Berlin and Wolfsburg. I had the interest from Monaco as well at that time. But Celtic happened really quickly. I mean, I've played for the national team against England. We drew 1-1. I played really well. And on the next day, the league already finished, international finished, and I was away with my friends to the seaside, just to rest. At that time, look, I haven't had money to pay my mobile phone bill, and my phone was disconnected. They couldn't contact me. Obviously, Celtic has made the approach, but they couldn't contact me for 2 days. I remember we were out with the boys. It was about 6:30 in the morning, and one of the boys came in the room and said, the club is looking for you. And I went, we'll call them after. So in about 3 years' time, he's coming back, like storming in. And he's like, Stan, the club is looking for you. You have to go back to Sofia. And I went, what for? He said, I don't know, they're sending somebody to pick you up. He'll be here in about 3 hours. Right, what for? So I'm picking the phone, speaking, and say, well, you're flying to Glasgow tomorrow. Bear in mind, we'd just come back from a night out. We were all over the place, and I'm thinking, what do you mean? So they pick me up, take me to the club. There was two representatives from Celtic, the chairman of the club and the CEO of the club. So they said, you're flying tomorrow. I only pick up a pair of trousers, shirt, a blazer, and I went.
So I'm guessing you've said, yeah, I'm interested. They're not just saying, you've got to go.
I haven't, there's not even a question.
You're off. Like,
and they said, well, one of your teammates is coming with you. Milan Petkov, we played together. And he said, he's coming with you. Apparently the interest is for both of you. And I went, oh, that's even brilliant. And the next day, flight on, into Glasgow. That time, I've told you, a pair of trousers, T-shirt, blazer. That was it. We stayed there for a week. I had to wash my pants and my shirt in the sink just to make sure I was wearing the same clothes pretty much. I never had anything with me. They put the offer in. The money was really low. The other player, he was, he had a family. He had already a kid. He had a wife as well. For youngster, it's just, in my thoughts, in my head, I've never been about money. It's about playing in the highest level, achieving and developing and doing the right things. I remember the offer was about $300 a week, which was really low to be honest, but it was three times more than I was earning in Bulgaria.
But so what are they paying for you as a fee? As in the transfer
4.5 million.
So you should never be on 300?
Never. Never.
What are you being paid in Bulgaria, sorry?
$5,000 a year. So for me, it was like a lot more than I was earning. But you forget one thing. You don't live in Bulgaria.
No.
You live in a completely different place. The demand is completely different. The expenses, everything was different. But for me, it was not like that. Obviously, I've realized that very quickly. A few months down the line, when my phone bill... the language was a big issue for me. My phone bill was £6,000. Imagine that, £6,000. It was ridiculous because I was constantly on the phone. I was constantly on the phone with my girlfriend, with my friends, literally after training because there was no communication between me and my teammates, the manager.
So that's another phone cut off then.
And that's another phone, yeah. But look, it was one of these things that I'll come back and literally I'll be on the phone from like 2 in the afternoon until late in the
evening. Didn't know what else to do.
The language barrier, I couldn't understand it. I couldn't speak. I couldn't say what I was going through. For me, it was like, you know what, just speaking with somebody, finding a solution or maybe... finding that kind of comfort zone to say everything is okay, but it wasn't okay. It wasn't okay because I wasn't playing. I was playing as a right back. I was shocking at a right back at the start. Financial issues, the language, the culture, everything. So for me, it was like so many things. And bear in mind, my dad was demanding. I was going through difficult times. I went through different stages of trouble. But this was completely new for me.
With all of that going on then, how easy is it to be swallowed up by the dressing room?
If the dressing room don't accept you, you're a lost cause.
You start, I'm guessing you was isolating yourself because of the language and then suddenly all the problems feel so much more.
Well, you look in the morning, you go in the morning, you don't speak to anyone. You don't get involved with anything. Training finish, you go home, you don't communicate, the players going for lunch, they're associating, they're saying things, they're discussing things. You're not part of it. And they don't take you as a part of it. They feel like, well, who is he? What is like? What is like to do? Does he have problems? Few of the players were trying, but there was, for me, it was like... non-existence. It's like I didn't speak the language. I couldn't understand anything. I wasn't playing very well. And I just couldn't wait. You know, sometimes you just can't wait to go home. Mm. I felt like home is my comfort zone. I just wanted to be there rather than to be in the dressing room and the training ground. For me, it was completely different issues and troubles that I have to deal with because I usually wanted to sort and fix my problems on the pitch and in the training ground, in the dressing room, but I never had that opportunity.
Sounds like you both played out of position early on in your careers.
Yeah, I think you have to get opportunity sometimes.
Both right back.
Yeah, I mean, when you're the young lad...
I know how difficult it is.
When you're the young lad coming through, often you plug holes in teams, and like, if it's just to get a game, you'll play wherever you can. But that would have been real difficult for Stan, not knowing the language and coming into a dressing room, not being able to integrate yourself into the squad and feel accepted. Did you have any sort of second thoughts that this might not be for me and about going home?
Yes, many times. I packed my bags a few times. But then there was one thing that was stopping me, Luke. It was the failure. I didn't want to be a failure. And I think with the pressure, and I keep going back to him, that's why we start with the leadership and you made as a leader or you become a leader. And, you know, that pressure from my dad was like, you cannot give up. He's like understanding that he's watching over me. I would not speak to him about it. You know, if he calls and he say, how's everything? I go, yeah, it's brilliant. But it was not brilliant. But then I had to find solution myself. He wasn't there. He wasn't there. My family wasn't there. My friends wasn't there. I became a friend with one of the security guys. He saw me going down one of the games and I couldn't explain to the physio what's wrong with me. So he picked me up after the game. He took me home. And the next morning, you know, with the hands language, you know, that's the best language in the world. He tried to explain that in the morning he'll pick me up and he'll take me to training again. So we started English lessons. You know, he tried to explain to me about parts of the body and, you know, little things and that. And he had a burger van. So his wife was working there every day, and he took me to a restaurant one day, and he wanted me to order. It's part of the learning that we tried to set up for me to kind of go back to and understand a little bit more, fit in. And he said to me, "Well, when my wife works after training, let's go there, and you can listen to little phrases, you know, about how people place orders, how they deal with it." And in about 6 months, I saw a completely different Stylian Petrov. I saw him, you know, players loved it. You know, I can see the smile on their face, you know, going in and just saying good morning, and they'll say, good morning, how are you? And then the conversation starts, they can see I'm trying. If you don't show the effort, they won't show
the
effort.
Was that the turning point? Learning the language.
Yeah, that was a turning point, because then I could understand a little bit more what's happening in the dressing room. There was issues with John Barnes, and then he left, and then Kenny Dalglish took over. So I've started to understand a little more. I can express my concerns about what I feel. You know, I'm not a right back, because I felt as Celtic when I went, they were playing me right back, and I'm like, do they really know what my strength is, and what position that I play, what I stand for? It was like, and then when John Barnes left, I started speaking a little bit with Kenny, and we had the discussions about what I play, what I feel comfortable, what's my issues, what I've been through, and they kind of start helping, and everything will start changing.
You talked a lot about not wanting to fail there. We've looked at learning.
Who wants to fail?
Everybody wants to fail. You're not allowed to fail.
I know.
You learn the language. I think you broke your leg early on as well. All these things are going on. You're away from home. But what did success look like for you then? What was your ultimate goal?
To compete against the best players. And that was the Premier League. That was my goal at that time. As Celtic, I knew that I'll develop myself, because it was a huge club with a great history. And I was playing with some great teammates. I mean, Henry Klaassen and Paul Lambert and Neil Lennon and Alan Thompson, Chris Sutton, then Johan Mjalby. You've got international players, big characters that you can only learn from them. But I want to compete against the best. You know, I want to compete against, you know, the likes of Steven Gerrard and Frank Lampard, the players that play in my position and I always looked up to. So for me, success was that, being able to compete and be recognised that you can play in that level. This is a success for me, not 100 caps or not that. It's like when you retire, people to say, he had a decent career. he was a good player. He had something different about himself, and you know what? This was success for me because I wanted to play at that level and compete at that level.
Same for you.
I feel like I probably overachieved with the ability that I was given. You know, you work as hard as you can to get as high as you can, and I think playing in the Premier League and representing my country, I would never have dreamed of doing that.
But you start pushing to the limits. There's no limits for us. Eh? When you fight for something and where you want to achieve it, I remember when, you know, I just start playing and for Celtic, I was physically, I wasn't there. The game was too physical, too fast for me, and I had to do extra. I mean, I will train, look, and I'll go in the park and I'll run. That was literally going to be every night just for me to be able to sustain that level for a longer period of time. There's no limit. You know, my wife would sometimes say, are you not tired? Yeah, I'm tired, but my purpose is, you know, for me to achieve it, you have to go there. There's no limits. Mm. You know, people talk about players and going through difficult times. There's no limit. There's no limit in your brain and physical endurance and ability to what you can achieve. And I had to do it. But I had to do it in a different way.
You won a lot of trophies in Scotland, but when did you know you were ready for the Premier League?
I thought I was ready, but I was completely confused about it. I remember the spot with Alan Thompson and Chris Sutton just before I left Celtic. And Alan Thompson, I think we were in Dubai on holiday, and he said to me, Stan, Premiership is the next level. You know, at that time, I played the European final. I had about already 50 games under my belt internationally, played in the Champions League, won trophies, won Player of the Year. You're thinking, we'll be fine. We'll be fine. Wow. You know, I remember first time facing Stevie G and something that I always wanted to play against, I couldn't go even near him. Look, I couldn't go even near him. He was so sharp. He was so quick. He was everywhere. And I'm thinking, wow. This is a completely different level. So I had to change again everything. I had to add individual problems, you know, for my upper body strength, for my legs power, for my endurance, for analyzing the game in a different way. You go back to square one. It's like, you know, when you think I'm ready, I can do it. You're thinking, I can't do it. I have to do it all over again.
I heard a lot there about Steven Gerrard. Did you ask for a shirt at any time?
I've got about four of his shirts. I've got an England shirt, Liverpool shirt, a few Liverpool ones. I've got a few.
Stan had real good football intelligence, and it doesn't take you long to understand, right, I'm not at this level. What do I need to do to get there? And football finds you out very quickly. So you would have understood that, right, okay, this is gone again and I need to do more. I was surprised to hear that you didn't exactly hit the ground running before I got there, because obviously I saw the Stan Petrov, he was the finished article in midfield, you know, running the show. But it turns out that you was asked to play right midfield.
Yeah, I was. And you know, the funny thing is, when I went to Villa, Martin O'Neill started rebuilding the team, and a lot of players were unhappy, a lot of players were leaving, a lot of new players were coming in. So I had to play as a right wing. I mean, one of the games I had to play against Ashley Cole. I mean, you know how fast I am. I had to beat him. And Martin O'Neill at halftime was going, Stillian, get the ball and run at him. And I'm thinking, Gaffer, how am I going to run him? He's quicker than me. He's sharper than me. I had to be smarter. But then I found it really difficult. And as I say, I wasn't ready for that level. The speed, the physicality, it was the next level from what I've experienced. So Martin O'Neill put me on the bench, even though in the squad for nearly 4 months. 4 months. Jim Henry, do you remember, he's a fitness coach? I had to go sit down with him and I say, I have to be stronger. I have to be more powerful. I have to be sharper. Forget about weights. Forget about anything. I have to be able to get around the pitch. I have to be quick. I have to be sharp on my turns. I have to be more powerful.
Did that hinder the start of your Villa career?
Yes, one of the games, we lost against Fulham, and we were walking down the tunnel where you can hear somebody just shouting, Petrov, you useless. And we, you know what, fans have the right to do that. But when you hear that, and my wife and my kids were there, and my wife heard about it, and he said, did you hear that? And I went, yeah, I did. And the next game, it was not an opportunity for me to go and show something different. I was dropped straight away. And for me, it was like, whoa.
You've been a captain everywhere you've played. Why do you think you're a good captain?
My teammates and people around me could talk about it. But I always wanted to be the right example. I think probably that's where I want to start. It's about the team performance, team environment. I've played under a lot of great captains, some good ones, some bad ones. I've always tried to take the positive from every single one and adjust it. And I remember, you're never happy when we don't do enough in training, and you always want to do more, and you go and do extra when you're a captain, because four or five players will follow him. They'll do the same thing. And this is what you want to see. So you don't have to address that. You have to probably address it with the players that don't play enough, where they mentally are not there, to make sure they're ready when that moment comes. You have to be more a listener than a leader. You have to listen, you have to absorb, and you have to have the right moments to address that issue. I used to go quite first in training, you know, just to see the mood of the players when they're coming in and training. And, you know, most of them were good as gold, except Big John Carew. I mean, with John Carew, but you know, I had to understand John. John was like, he was like a big baby. Big John was like a big baby. And you have to really be careful what you say, how you say it, how to treat him, when to speak with John, when to be aggressive, when to be softer. This was very important. The way John was thinking, the way he was built as a character. The important for me as a captain was about Saturday. I mean, John sometimes will turn up, he won't even bother training. I mean, he won't even care. But then for me, it was about how I'm going to help the manager and the team and John to be the best on Saturday. And it was very easy with John. You know what? You just feed him with the positive news, with encouraging him, making sure he's the best, and John will never back down. One game, I've played the ball to him, he couldn't hold it, and I went for him. I mean, at halftime, we had a massive argument. Second half, John was not existent. You know what? Sometimes players, I'll go to Luke, I'll challenge him, we'll square, but I know that Luke will react. You tried to show me that, you know what, you're wrong.
Stand regularly, in games. Say you didn't start well, or you misplaced a pass, or you didn't get tight enough, you went, oi! And he'd look over you and he'd give you the Petrov stare, and you knew that, you know, you've got to raise your game a little bit here.
What does the Petrov stare look like, sorry?
Come on, sir. I can't show it.
More of a shout and a stare.
We're in a nice environment here, I can.
He wasn't just vocal, it was the way he performed as well, and we would follow him into battle, if you like, and he was a top captain.
Yeah, and the Christmas party was always good, so that helped as well.
Organisation.
Yeah.
Was that your job?
Yeah, I had to.
You had a lot of jobs.
Yeah, and everybody was there. Everybody was brilliant, and you know what? We had a good team. We had a strong guys. We could drink, we could play, we could, you know what? It was great banter. It was great people in the dressing room, and when you have that. In a team environment, it makes you stronger.
Do you reflect on 105 appearances for Bulgaria? Do you reflect on the fact that you made the Premier League? You played against these guys that you looked up to?
I do. I mean, some big names has played in a Bulgarian national team, some huge, huge names. And to hold the record of most caps in one country, it takes a lot of bravery, I think, first, you know what, to be accountable, honor and consistency.
Longevity think, is difficult.
Yes, yeah, it's really difficult. I mean, I think I've only, I've started probably 95% of the games. I mean, to be so consistent, to stay away from injuries, to be part of this national team through good and bad times and still be selected for all those years, it talks a lot about a person. I mean, 105 games, that's a lot. when I think back now, is I'm thinking, well, wow, how did that happen? But as Luke said, I always looked after myself when I left Bulgaria, to be honest. I looked after myself. I understood what is to be professional and what is required to be fit and ready for every single game. Because when you play international football, it's not just playing the games, but all the traveling, you know, going back to your club and be consistent and be recalled again and be consistent again and doing it over a number of years consistently. It's really difficult. So I do understand what I've achieved. I'm really proud. I think my dad is really proud. My family is really, really proud. And, you know, end of the day, the records are there to be broken. That's what I believe. I hope that will happen. It looks like it's not going to happen soon. So I hope that will happen. And what I feel and what I'll be feeling and what my kids, my family, other people can experience that as well.
Now, none of what you persevered through on the pitch could have prepared you for your leukemia diagnosis in 2012. We haven't spoken about Martin O'Neill yet, so I just wondered, first of all, Stillian, Martin played a big role in your treatment, your recovery.
Yeah, he did. I love Martin O'Neill. Martin is either you love him, or you don't love him. That's the way he goes with certain players. And he played a big part when I started playing for Celtic. He's a bit, I say everywhere, look, he's weird in probably the nicest way. He's just one of these. He was always late. He's still late. Just to let you know, look, he still calls you at random times at night about 12 o'clock, talking about football, talking about stuff. And he told me when I was a Celtic that I have to get fit, I have to lose weight if I want to play in his team. So that's where our journey with Martin O'Neill started. I managed to do that and I've never looked back. But going back to his support through my probably the most important and the most difficult battle in life was going through my treatment and leukemia. He was one of these guys that, he was turning up to the hospital in random times. You know, there's certain visiting times that you can go and visit people, and especially when they don't have immune system, when they're under course of, you know, catching viruses, bacteria. I was in isolation. He would just turn up at 11 o'clock at night. I mean, who turns up at 11 o'clock at night? Like, and he would sit there for hours talking about stuff. Bear in mind, that time, I'm exhausted. I was wiped out. But this man would just sit there, would pay attention, will get his time, and I'll fall asleep and you get up and leave. And the next visit will be again randomly and certain time when a nurse will come and say, well, you've got a visitor, sorry, but you have to be quick. 2 hours later, he's still there. If you know the history of Martin, his wife, Geraldine, she went through leukemia battle as well. And obviously most of our discussion and talking points will be through what to expect, how to deal with it, side effects, how she dealt with it. So most of that will be around my battle and my fight. We'll talk about a little bit about football, and how it's going to be about Celtic and Villa, about the current results and stuff like that, the way football is changing. So literally will be a lot of topics, but mainly will be about my battle. And it was really difficult because my wife was there, Paulina. She was there. And, you know, as much as she loved to see people there, we weren't allowed many visitors because I was in isolation for about nearly a year, Luke. And we lived in like one little room. I mean, you know, we're talking about preparation and, you know, opportunity to fight and have the chance to become a good player. You always find the solution. But this situation, when I was diagnosed, there was no answers. There was no preparation for it. There was no, like, you can look at get a template from somebody and say, well, he succeeded because of that. It's not such a thing. it was completely new for us. Our life changed. We had to, you know what, put our kids aside. I couldn't see them for months. We had to give our kids to our parents to look after them because we were constantly in the hospital in London. And, you know what, there were so many questions in my head about what is right, what is wrong, why me, how did that happen? Could anybody give me the right treatment? Because there was hundreds and hundreds of treatments and protocols out there. You have to sign your own chemotherapies and some of the side effects are coma, losing your speech, you know, problems with your bones. And you're thinking, do I have to sign this? I mean, I haven't learned that in school. I haven't gone through my life experience, you know, broken my arm, broken my leg, and, you know, I'll argue with my wife or my parents. This is a completely different thing. So who gives you the right choices? Who tell you what to do? It's completely new. I was like fighting for my life. And you know, the worst thing is, look, is like when you go through moments like that, you appreciate life even more. Because you know what you can lose, and that's your life. And everything you've worked for, everything you've achieved, good, bad moments, you know, being a dad, getting married, succeeding in football, all of a sudden, that was just going to be wiped out. And what you have to do is fight for not just your legacy as who you at that moment, but also a legacy that you can leave after that with your battle. And it was something that I could not accept it. I could not accept it. And it took us to hell. It took us through really difficult moments. Mentally, I was all over the place. I had to stop my treatment as well. I was just exhausted. At the end, it was just exhausted. I was a completely different person. I was overweight. I haven't had any strength mentally, physically. I wasn't allowed to see anyone. I mean, being in a house and not be able to sit with your kids, they had to be in a different room because I didn't have an immune system. I mean, who prepares you for that?
Can I ask you, Stan, when you say I had to stop my treatment, had you almost given up? Like, I don't want to do this anymore. I can't go on.
I was just ready to give up. I said to my wife, I mean, I said, I'm not going with it. Doctors, Paulina, my parents, they were just, you have to go. It was a little bit to go. And I went, no, I'm not going to it. There's no more energy or will for me to push. You come to a point, it was like, you don't know if it's tiredness, exhaustion. It was like one of these things is I wasn't even thinking straight.
You had nothing left.
That's nothing. What you felt like. Nothing. I just said, I just want to go home. Whatever happens, happens. But probably at that time, because my treatment was over 3 years, max, it was like probably I've done enough chemotherapies and that. So my last little bit, I didn't complete it. I wasn't able to do it. I wasn't able to do it. I mean, we had some funny moments, you know, now when recollecting it with my wife and what we've been through. And I mean, Paulina went mad one day because she told the nurses never to cry in front of me. Or I became friends with a lot of the patients. And she said, if he comes to work or anyone don't make it, just don't tell him. Just no negativity, no negative news, just everything positive. Mm. So for me, I remember it was my birthday and the nurses, I was obviously chatty. I was, you know, trying to get a treadmill into the ward and, you know, possible to do exercise. After 3 months, I couldn't move.
Yeah.
But they managed to do that. So on my birthday, they sang a little bit and two of the nurses start crying. And I started crying as well, obviously emotional and everything. So Paulina found out and she went ballistic to the nurses that I've told you, no negativity around here. It was crazy, crazy things. But this is the moments that, you know, I appreciate even more, even now. I can never get away with it, you know, having a foundation, charity foundation is like, you can never get away with it. You know, sometimes don't think that I'm different than anybody else. And you guys, you know, sometimes you kind of want to shut it down and don't think about it and then don't discuss it. But I don't know if it's my path or what I have to do helping others, but, you know, I'm there. I'm there and I still get involved with a lot of people that go through treatments and difficult times, and you become part of their story. And when you have a foundation and you help others, there's more and more that are coming forward, and you just can't stop thinking about it.
I think in those moments of doubt, you have to just be reminded of how many people you're helping. Was there a particular conversation you were speaking about fellow cancer patients that you were getting to know? Is there something that you remember that really stands out?
I remember every single one of them. I mean, at the moment, even now, from yesterday, I'm dealing with two cases. One is a 6 years old. The other one is a more older man. He's 68. They're going through different treatments, and not every time they want a financial support. Sometimes they want a psychological and mental support about speaking with somebody who's going through it. So last night I had a conversation with the father of the little kid about what to expect and how to deal with it and what was the issues. You know, he had some side effects. And, you know, sometimes, you know, helping others is great. They take it. They're very positive. You get a text in the next morning, you really help us, you know. Now we think in a completely different way. We're more positive. I'm glad that I spoke to you. But sometimes you're thinking, yeah, but the memories are hitting back. The memories are hitting back, and you go through everything that you've gone through. It, you know, even sometimes my wife don't ask me about it.
Of you wants to forget about that episode in your life, but you can't get away from it because of your foundation, you're helping people.
I'd love to. Look, I'd love to just somebody can take away from my memory, it will be great. But unfortunately, it don't work like that. And when you see that, you know, or going through that conversation, it's really because you have to be very careful what you're saying, because people are looking for a little percentage of positivity or something to give them, everything will be fine. Don't worry about it. But it just don't work like that. So you have to be really careful. You have to be really concentrated on what you're saying. And it becomes a lengthy time, because now they're starting their treatment, but that treatment, that kid will go through a 3-year treatment. And this won't stop today, tomorrow, though, a month later. He will go through it. He'll go through the challenges, and these parents will still communicate with me. And you know what? Going further down the line, I've promised that I will go and see him. And you know what? He's a football fan, and he's one of these things that you just can't get away from.
Did you speak to a therapist afterwards?
My wife suggested that. I think my wife is a good therapist, to be honest. She's been really good. I think we've changed so many things in our lives, you know, food and stress and everything involved, you know, connected with cancer and leukemia. She's done so much research, and she's been great. I mean, how good is to have somebody beside you who kind of put her life on hold because of me. You know, I was always providing, and she was always there. She was brilliant with the kids, home. She was brilliant, but I was the one who was providing. But all of a sudden, that was put in balance. So she just went, my life, kids' life, away from it, it's about you. And, you know, she never complained. She never complained. It's brilliant. It's brilliant. And it's great to see we're still together. She's still doing my head in. You know that look, you know, Paulina. And you know what, it's great to have someone. And you know what, since we met up, we're still brilliant together, and it's really enjoyable.
It's good to hear. Luke, do you remember when you saw the 19th minute became such a great moment, especially at Villa Park, to clap for Stan Petrov?
Yeah, for sure. And I also, going back to when Stan was first diagnosed, I remember it was quite quickly on Sky Sports, and it was quite on the headlines and stuff like that. So immediately I've rung one of our teammates, James Collins. I've said, what is going on? What's happened to Stan? No one really knew. It was just like, came straight away, literally like national news on Sky. So he said, it's not looking good. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, been diagnosed with leukemia. I said, but what happened the weekend then? So
because I've played that weekend.
Stan would be able to help more with this story, but yeah. I believe it was Arsenal away. And Ginge actually said to me, he said, I feel absolutely awful. I said, why? So he said, they're coming at half time and Stan, they're having a bad time of it. I think they're trailing at the Emirates.
Yeah.
And Stan says, listen, guys, I'm not feeling right here. I've got to come off. And I think Ginger's then shouted across the dressing room, you're supposed to be captain. You can't just leave us now, blah, blah, blah. Come on, you've got to stay on, Stan. And he said, obviously, the next day, it happened really, really quickly, didn't
really
it?
Quickly.
You found out what was going on. And Ginger said, I feel absolutely horrendous because there was some expletives shouted across. Are you, blah, 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 you're supposed to be captain and all that. So that was the first. I mean, I went into a bit of shock and I probably froze and didn't really know what to do. So probably didn't reach out enough. But at that moment, you're thinking, this family, Stan, Paulina, the kids, his immediately close relatives, they've just had the worst news that they could ever possibly have. Do they need to be bombarded with calls and texts and that? You kind of freeze as like a teammate and a friend, and you don't really know what to do or what to say. But looking back now, I wish I'd have probably reached out more. And like he said, though, not many people were allowed to come and see him, and we didn't really know, was he going into treatment straight away, this type of thing. But going back to what you said there, Max, I remember seeing it on the telly and obviously getting emotional looking at Stan in the crowd and knowing Paulina and the kids and stuff. And I think the support of the thousands and probably millions out there, because Celtic and Villa and all the clubs and all the people in Bulgaria probably helped him, I would have fought through the illness, and no surprise a man like Stan managed to come through and win that battle.
You know, it's funny you're saying that you've never reached, but what I found out is I've never even thought about it. I always thought that the support was brilliant, but for me it was to focus of what I'm doing and what is right or wrong, which treatment and what protocol is the right, listening to the professors. But when I actually went through it, look, I found out and I realized that not many people know what is right and wrong and how to approach in this situation. And I see it now with a lot of patients, a lot of families. I had a couple months ago, one of the dads is saying, well, you know what? He used to have a lot of friends, a 12-year-old kid. He used to have a lot of friends. They used to come here. Now the parents, we don't see them. Nobody's calling. I say, well, listen, this is normal. Not everybody know how to approach in this situation. Nobody, a normal person would not know what is right, what is wrong, what to say, what not to say. And sometimes you need to give space and time and that will come back. And that's what I realized as well. Look, it's like people just don't know what to say and how to say. And they feel like, I'd rather stay, watch it from a distance. They're actually saying something that is not right or maybe will affect whatever is happening. But going back to the Arsenal game, yeah, I was halftime, just felt a little bit a cold before the game, just normal cold, but you know us, you go in the sauna, few pills, you know, and you're out there, you train, you sweat out, you're back to normal. But no, this time was, first half was just my muscles, my brain were functioning completely different. There was no energy, there was no desire, there was no fight in me. I was kind of one of these moments when you just thinking now, I just didn't want to be there. I knew something was going on, but you never thought that this was going to be that what it became. At halftime, I literally just took all my clothes, like, the kit was off, I was naked and I was sitting, I was exhausted. Bear in mind, it was only first 45 minutes. Usually I sweat quite a lot. So I was sitting and I was dripping even more. I'm thinking this something is not right. And Alex McLeish came in and he was saying, usually when I played against Mikel Arteta and he was playing for Arsenal, he played for Rangers, I played for Celtic, I love competing against him. And I always put him under pressure. I knew where he was strongest. I don't let him turn. I was always in his face. But this time, I was second best. It was nowhere near. Alex McLeish had a go. He's like, Stan, he loved playing against Arteta. Nothing is working today. Pull your finger out. And I just, that's when I went. He's like, Gaffer, something's not right. I think I should come off. That's where Ginge, Warney as well, Dunny, you know, that I always pushed them because it was important time for us. We were not just not getting the right results, but we were bottom the table. Mm. And for me it was one of these moments when they all jumped and I was like, Stan, you always push us. You're the leader, you're the captain, we're going through a difficult time. I don't know if it's the adrenaline or, you know what, kind of subconscious, is you thinking, I can't let them down. I have to keep going. Bear in mind, I went in the second 45, I've played. Honestly, I don't remember anything. But you know the funny things? After the game, I felt all right. I went and done my cold bath. That was the main thing. I was already had cancer in my blood, which acute lymphoblastic leukemia. It's cancer in your blood. And I went to do my cold bath because we were playing Chelsea the following week. And I was already thinking for the games again. Forget about what happened halftime.
That's you ticking the boxes again. Like yeah. I said, the professional yeah. element of Stan.
And then I went in the bus. And that's where it really hit me. I mean, I felt really exhausted. Really, really exhausted. And remember, they were preparing food after the game, just making sure the recovery is right. So the chef came and said, Stan, what are you having? I usually had the wrap and that. He said, you want a wrap? I went, no, I'm not hungry at all. Further down the journey, I started feeling a little bit hot. And I'm like, what the hell? So I went to see the doc. And I said, Doc, I'm not really fit. I'm not feeling well. I think I've got a temperature. Measured the temperature. It wasn't that bad. 38.1. In the normal world, in a household, you'll think you get a little temperature. You know, let's see how. You say, okay, we're playing Chelsea. Let's see, get a few tablets. Let's see if we can stop it. Went back home. Then, because of the tablets, I took quite a lot of tablets and the temperature went down. Went in the next day, done my recovery, hot and cold, done my stretch in the pool, done my sauna, and then I went home. And then the next day, Dr. McGuinness, he said, we'll do a random blood checks. And that's where everything started. My counts were off in 2 days later. We played Sunday. By Thursday, I was diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic leukemia. But you know what? The doctor gave it to me. He's like, you're ordering a food. You got acute. You've been diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic leukemia. We're 99.9% certain that it's that. You have to start treatment straight away. But we're gonna wait for another test, which will come in tomorrow morning. Guys, this was the longest night in my life. I didn't even blink. I didn't sleep. By 10 o'clock, nothing. And I'm sent to Polina, no news. It's a good news. But half 10, we had the confirmation. Half 10, they confirmed it. And they said to me, you have to start treatment straight away. What do you mean I have to start treatment straight away? How? What? How long is it? There's no news about it. So I had to go for a second opinion. That's when I spoke with Martin O'Neill. He always talked about his wife being looked after from a great professor down in London. He managed to get me an appointment with him. I came down to London in a space of 5 hours. That was confirmed from a second opinion from another professor. And the following week, I started the treatment. My journey started.
You've spoken a lot about your wife in these moments, but I think a central theme of this show has been your dad as well. And you've mentioned at the start of the show that was, I think, the second time you ever saw him cry. Do you remember that moment?
It was in the house. He only came to hospital once. He only came to the hospital once. I don't think he could have taken it. I think he was really proud of what I've achieved as a player. And I think he couldn't accept it. He couldn't accept it. But I remember after the first 3 months, they were not allowed to see me for the first 3 months. The treatment is out down in London. We weren't allowed any visitors. I was in a very high dose of steroids, chemotherapy as well. And when you take a lot of steroids, high doses of steroids, you develop that moon face. This was the first time after 3 months, my mom and dad are back home in Birmingham with the kids. That was the first time when they saw me, and I could see the shock in their eyes. Mm. They were like, "Who is this?" That's when my dad really went like crying, and I looked at him, went and hugged him. And he, you know what, when you haven't heard anyone cry, you're like, at one point it's like,
you're like, consoling him. Yeah, you're the one who needs the cuddle.
And it was strange for me. I mean, it was always the other way around, like you mentioned. And this time it was me when I was going through my biggest battle in life. I had to go and comfort him. And for me, it was really strange. It was really strange. And I remember calming down, and, you know, we sat down and we talked about, you know, what I've been through in the first 3 months, what to expect, and everything is going well. And I think when you give them that news, they kind of relax a little bit more. But this is the time when I saw him really weak and vulnerable, but probably is the normal reaction.
When you've won your battle, you decide to try and give it one last go, getting back to being a professional again. Can you talk us through that a little bit?
Obviously, I've started playing a little bit of vets football. But, you know, sometimes muscle memory don't lie. And I started kind of working. Do you remember Ryan? He used to maintain the pools, and he used to do everything on the training ground. But then he became a PT.
Mm.
Fitness coach. He went to do his degree. And we started working. I just started as just to get fit. I mean, I've put about 50 something kilos on the top of what I was.
Wow.
Yeah. So we started doing bits and pieces together. The first year, I remember, we started, and I was still in treatment. So we started like easily. I was still in treatment every 3 months. Maintenance, called maintenance. For 2 years, I had to be on maintenance every 3 months. You go for a week, you take a injection, and then you have everything is on tablets. So I could kind of moderate and make sure that I do the right things, the doses and everything. So we started working, and I started losing weight. I started playing in the vets team, and I was still in treatment. Bear in mind, I was playing the vets for. That's how much I love football. But then when you start playing like 90 minutes, and even I was heavy, I was still going around, you know, I was still trying to do a little bit more. But like from game to game, I was getting fitter and fitter and fitter and fitter. And one point, Ryan said to me, "Do you think you can play football again?" I mean, I was only 34. And I went, "I don't know.
Do you think I can play football again?"
Yeah, I said to him, "Do you think I can play football again?" He said to me, "Why not?" But I said, "Ryan, if we look into it, I'm overweight. I don't have the muscle. I have to lose the weight. I have to build the muscle. I have to strengthen the muscle. I have to get my endurance. I have to get my power. Mentally, I have to be there." I say, "Well, why we just don't leave it now? I'll put a plan for you, and then we'll see where we go." So a year later, I was under 95 kilos. And he say, "Okay, now we push another year. Are we going to go for it?" And I went, "You're joking." He said, "Yeah, I can see it. I think you can do it." And look, honestly, we were training 6 times a week, sometimes twice. He had to do it. He had to do it very gradually because I couldn't afford to get injured. I said to him, "I'll tell you one thing. I'll give it a go. But if I get injured, that's it, done." So he was very cautious about, first of all, diet, then training, then loading, then the same thing is mentally we were working, you know, where I am at the moment, can I push even harder? So we had to really work closer. I mean, I still got every single sessions of what we've done. I had to buy sledges. I had to buy boxes that I jump, everything. I mean, if you look at my
house. This is the challenge again that this you want. This is what he needs.
But I loved it. Yeah. I loved it. And when it gave me that idea and I said to Paulina, I think I can play again. And she went, don't be silly. But then when I got kind of fitter, I called my professor. I said, Prof, I think I'll give it another go. He go, what do you mean? I say, I would like to play again. And he went, oh, Stan, I'm not sure about that. When he said that, I'm like, what? He said, well, listen, there's a little concern here because somebody who's been that long on the steroids, it could make your bones vulnerable. You can break it quicker and easier. And I went, what do you mean? And he go, well, this is the side effects of, you know, high doses of steroids. And got back, spoke with Ryan, and I'm Ryan, And he was like, what do you think? And I went, we're getting close. Let's push it again. So I remember doing my first four falls with Ryan. I think the first 4 minutes we covered about, I'm not joking, look, 150 meters. That was my first, it wasn't a run. It was like literally crawling. That was my first, you know, in the country lanes. It was like, I could hardly walk. I was that heavy with that much chemotherapy. Bear in mind, my liver has been hammered with everything. So I had to make sure I detox my liver. I make sure my organs are good to take that much load. And when I actually hit 89 kilos and I was powerful, I was strong, I could feel it. I was still playing the vets football and I can see the difference straight away. I mean, I was getting quicker, I was getting powerful. 90 minutes, I'll run up and down. And I'm thinking, yeah. So I spoke with Villa and they were like, what? But then it's another issue because when you retire, your contract kind of finishing, there's issues about payments and tags and stuff like that. So they were like, oh, we're not sure about that. We need to look at it. You may not be able. I say, guys, you don't realize I'm not asking you for money. I'm asking you to come and give it a go. Give it a go. It was the best thing that happened. I felt alive again. I was really nervous, you know, when I was younger. You know, before start of the season, you had to do different tests. You work, but you work outside the football environment. You do your own things. You work with somebody, but it's not the same when you work in a professional football club. So I had to go, and I was one of the tops. And, you know, those results, you know, strength and power and jumping and endurance and everything. And I felt when I went back home, I had a massive smile. And Villa said to me, no problem, we'll give you a go. And I went to a preseason. Gabby was funny that day. I haven't missed this training session. I haven't missed 1 second of that preseason. Bear in mind, with those 3 years, 4 years already, I haven't been through so much. Treatments, chemotherapies, highs and lows in life, dealing with different situations. And I was given opportunity to train again. I loved it every day. I mean, Di Matteo was the manager then. It was ruthless. I mean, you were training twice a day. One of the sessions was just literally trainers running. The other one was 2 hours of football. I haven't missed one session.
I remember at this stage, noise coming out of the dressing room. Someone spoke to Brad Guzan. They went, Stan is absolutely flying. Like, he's going to do this, you know. It's looking like he's going to get a contract and he's going to be part of the squad. So can you talk us through why that didn't?
Yeah, I can. It was a strange one. Everything was going well. I think they were really happy. And you know what I noticed with the boys? Even they haven't had to make the decision then. I was not under contract. Nobody was under pressure for me to start the season, or is a deadline, or is a date for me to try to come back. For me, it was about having that opportunity build up and be ready. But what I saw when I went to that preseason, everybody else was like, I was running, I was not giving up, and everybody raised their performances, their running ability another 20%, because they don't want to be seen by beaten by somebody who just had 3 years of chemotherapy and beating leukemia. You can see everybody's performances like going up. But we played the friendly game. We won 5-1. I set up 2 goals. That was the most I've played, 65 minutes. I felt really strong. And I can feel that, you know, it's coming back. You know, I've already had 2 games. One is 45 minutes. The other one is 65 minutes. And I can see I'm feeling good. I was, Di Matteo said to me, I'm really happy, Stan. You're doing really well. There's nothing I can say about that. Keep doing what you're doing, and we'll see where we are at the end. But that night after the game, Di Matteo flew to China to speak with the owner. And on a Tuesday, I was called in the office, and I was told that Villa won't offer me anything, and they can offer me a coaching role. I mean, at that time, there was a few questions that I asked. I said, well, what changed from Sunday to Tuesday? And I said, well, you don't have to make that decision now. There's no pressure on you. And plus, you can see it with your own eyes. I can be a positive, not a negative for you. You can see how everybody else reacting when I'm there. If I slide tackle, if I push them, if I shout, they have to outrun me, they have to outplay me. This is good for you. He said, well, that's a decision of the club, and we won't offer you. At that time, look, it's like, no, you would probably want to understand what I've been through, how much effort I've put to get there. And I was just devastated. I went back home. Paulina could see it straight away. And I called Ryan. I said, listen, they just called. They said, what? Why is that? And I just said, I don't know. Paulina was really like, how are you? I said, enough is enough. Let's go on holiday. I should have probably fought harder, but I was just tired. I just went, you know what? It's meant to happen. But maybe could have been for good. I'm still alive. I have the opportunity to speak with you guys. And if I've gone through, you never know, the strengths, maybe that would, the stress, that's what probably they will worry about. They have to deal and go through it again, the stress, the physical side of it, how I'm going to react, being out of the game for that long. So when you sit back further down the line, you may be thinking, you know, well, maybe they could have been right. I don't think they were right. I was there. I was ready. They never had to make that decision at that moment. But they've made it. And he's...
maybe it was to do with insurances and stuff off the field.
Could be. Should it be an issue?
No.
I feel like whoever's decision it was, they missed a trick regarding if you'd have got back on the pitch, whether it had been for one game, 10 games, whatever it would have been. The message that would have sent to people out there suffering terminal illnesses and the inspiration that would have fed to them, that you can beat it and you can get back on the pitch. Can you imagine how powerful that message would have been?
Well, that was the message, actually. I'm glad you were thinking and saying it that way. You know, when you go through something like that, your life changes. It's completely different. You look at life in a different way. But what I wanted to show, and I'll tell you what, I've never even sat down or talked to Villa about contract, about money, about land. Nothing. There was nothing. And I would never taken a penny. I'll tell you what, the message was different. There is life after these struggles, after what I've been through. You can go back to normality. You can find a solution and make sure that you can live your life. And you have to fight through it, but then you can go to the end of it and be something special again. And it was a great message for people. And, you know, I had so many nice messages and emails and letters, you know, for people that have been through this kind of moment. Some people find really difficult to go back to normal life and get a job and find the right environment to after their treatments. But, you know what, just doing the preseason and being around the media and giving that opportunity for people to believe again, it was great to see. But the message was more powerful than just football.
Thank you for answering all these questions, Stan. And I think we'll definitely put all the information in the show notes, but would you like to tell people how we can help out with the Stylian Petrov Foundation?
Most of the funds that we raise and the awareness is through the foundation, Stylian Petrov Foundation. We do events pretty much every year, games, golf days, dinners, lunches. And we're through a social media, the Stylian Petrov Foundation. They can always find us. They can find us. They can always drop us a text if they want to be part of it, if they want to start raising. And they don't have to forget that, you know, this little kindness and little acts can make a difference in people's life. And this sometimes is really important, not just financially, but mentally as well. People who suffer and go through moments like that, they need to understand that they are not alone, the way I felt when I was going through it.
It's amazing to hear you talk about it. And we're very grateful that you've come and spoken about your whole journey. I did want to ask you before we go, do you have a question for Luke?
It's just how is life? Because, you know, we've retired a long time ago, and how is life? How is he treating you? How is the family? And this is the main thing. Sometimes between friends, we forget to ask these questions, and I love to hear it.
Yeah, that's a question from a man with a new appreciation of gratitude to life, I'm sure, after what he's been through. So, yeah, no, life's good, Stan. Thanks for asking, mate. Kids are all good, growing up fast. Wife's good. Enjoying retirement and getting into different things like this podcast, which is putting myself out of my comfort zone a little bit, but fully enjoying it and having you on's been fantastic for us. So thank you.
I used to love the media. Wait, no, but it's great to see, and it takes bravery to come out and discuss and talk about things, and it's great to see you. I love the show, and I wish you good luck, guys, and I hope I can come again.
We'll definitely have you back
when you pass over 20 million views.
Thanks to this episode. I think the name of the show, More Than a Name. I want to ask you, when you hear your name, Stylian Petrov, what comes to mind?
Oh, that's interesting questions. Honesty, dedication, discipline, and I think legacy. I think we as human beings, you'd love to leave a legacy, innit? Look, and I think that's why I think with my name, I give hope to people that through difficult moments, through their dreams, either come one way or another, you can still become somebody and become something. And probably this is the four things I'll take when I say my name.
And we didn't even talk about his goal against Derby, did we?
We didn't, mate. But thank you very much for coming.
That'll be after when you reach the 20 million viewers. Then we can talk about it and we can show as well.
Stylian Petrov, thank you so much for your time. And we look forward to seeing you in episode 2 at some point. What a shirt, by the way.
Yeah, you like it? Yeah, that's the new fashion, apparently. Baggy and, yeah.
Celtic green,
yes.
Looking good. Please, if you're out there and you can, support the Stylian Petrov Foundation. You can follow our show at More Than a Name Pod, and we'll see you next week. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts and watch full episodes on YouTube. Get in touch with us by emailing morethananamepod@gmail.com and follow along on socials for more content at More Than a Name Pod.